I guess it is now my hometown. Sarah and I moved to Indianapolis in the summer of 2007. We drove a U-Haul with all our worldly belongings from the corner of 88th and Columbus in New York City to the corner of 86th and Ditch in Indianapolis, an extremely stressful 16-hour drive. When we finally arrived in Indianapolis, we unpacked our stuff and slept on an air mattress in our new home, the first place we'd ever owned. We were in our late 20s, and we'd bought this house a few weeks earlier after spending maybe a half hour inside of it. The house had 3 bedrooms, 2.5 baths, and a half-finished basement. Our mortgage payment was a third of what our New York rent had been. I couldn't get over how quiet and dark the house was that first night. I kept telling Sarah that someone could be standing right outside our bedroom window, and we wouldn't even know. And then Sarah would say, "Well, but probably not." And I'm just not the sort of person who is effectively comforted by probablys. So several times through the night, I got up from the air mattress and pressed my face against the glass of the bedroom window, expecting to see eyes staring back at me, but instead finding only darkness. The next morning, I insisted we buy some curtains, but first we had to drop off the moving van. At the U-Haul return place, a guy handed us some paperwork to fill out and asked us where we'd driven in from. Sarah explained that we had moved from New York for her job at the Indianapolis Museum of Art, and the guy said he'd been to the museum once as a kid. And then Sarah said, "So, what do you think of Indianapolis?" And the guy standing behind the counter at the U-Haul place paused for a moment before saying, "Well, you gotta live somewhere." Indianapolis has tried on a lot of mottos and catchphrases over the years. Indianapolis is raising the game. You put the I in Indy. Crossroads of America. But I'd propose a different motto. Indianapolis. You gotta live somewhere. There's no getting around Indianapolis's many imperfections. We are situated on the White River, a non-navigable waterway, which is endlessly resonant as metaphor, but problematic as geography. Furthermore, the river is filthy because our aging water treatment system frequently overflows and dumps raw sewage directly into it. The city sprawls in every direction, endless mini-malls and parking lots and nondescript office buildings. We don't invest enough in the arts or public transportation. One of our major thoroughfares is named Ditch Road, for God's sakes. Ditch Road. We could name it anything. Kurt Vonnegut Drive, Madam C.J. Walker Way, Rody McRoadface. But we don't. We accept Ditch. Someone once told me that Indianapolis is among the nation's leading test markets for new restaurant chains, because the city is so thoroughly average. Indeed, it ranks among the top so-called microcosm cities, because Indianapolis is more typically American than almost any other place. We are spectacular in our ordinariness. The city's nicknames include Naptown, because it's boring, and India No Place. When we first moved here, I would often write in the mornings at my neighborhood Starbucks at the corner of 86th and Ditch, and I would marvel at the fact that all 4 corners of that intersection contained strip malls. Although I lived less than a half mile from that Starbucks, I often drove because there were no sidewalks. The land had been given over to cars, to sprawl, to flat-roofed soullessness. I was disgusted by it. Living in a tiny apartment in New York City where we could never quite eradicate the mice, I had romanticized home ownership. But now that we actually had a house, I hated it. Indianapolis's favorite literary son, Kurt Vonnegut, wrote that one of the flaws in the human character is that everybody wants to build and nobody wants to do maintenance. Homeownership was all maintenance. There were always window treatments to install and light bulbs to change. The water heater kept breaking. And most of all, there was the lawn. God, I hated mowing the lawn. The lawn and the mini malls of 86th and Ditch became the two poles of my resentment. I couldn't wait for Sarah to get a job somewhere else. Vonnegut once said, "What people like about me is Indianapolis." He said that in Indianapolis, of course, to a crowd full of people from Indianapolis. But Kurt Vonnegut really did hold the city in high esteem. Toward the end of his life, he answered an interviewer's question by saying, "I've wondered where home is, and I realized it's not Mars or someplace like that. It's Indianapolis when I was 9 years old. I had a brother and a sister, a cat and a dog and a mother and father and uncles and aunts, and there's no way I can get there again." Vonnegut's greatest novel, Slaughterhouse-Five, is about a man who becomes unstuck in time and how time conspires with consciousness. It's about war and trauma, but it's also about not being able to get back to before the firebombing of Dresden, before the suicide of Vonnegut's mother, before his sister's early death. I believe that Vonnegut loved Indianapolis, but it's telling that from the time he could choose where to live, he did not choose to live here. Late in our first Indianapolis year, Sarah and I became friends with our neighbors Marina and Chris Waters. Chris was a former Peace Corps volunteer and Marina a human rights lawyer. Like us, they'd just gotten married, and like us, they were living in their first home. But unlike us, Chris and Marina loved Indianapolis. We'd often go to lunch together at Smee's, a little family-owned restaurant in one of the 86th and Ditch mini malls, and I would complain about lawn care and the lack of sidewalks. Once, Chris said to me, "You know, this is one of the most economically and racially diverse zip codes in the United States." And I said, "What?" And he said, "It is. You can Google it." So I did Google it, and he was right. The median home price near 86th and Ditch is $237,000, but there are also million-dollar houses and $700-a-month apartments. At that corner, there are Thai and Chinese and Greek and Mexican restaurants, all independently owned. There's a bookstore, a fair trade gift shop, two pharmacies, a bank, a Salvation Army, and a liquor store named after the constitutional amendment that repealed prohibition. Yes, the architecture is an unmitigated nightmare, but the people of Indianapolis have gone and made something beautiful anyway. Sit outside of Smee's for an afternoon, and you'll hear English and Spanish, Korean and Burmese, Russian and Italian. The problem was never 86th and Ditch, which turns out to be a great American intersection. The problem was me. And after Chris called my assumptions into question, I began to think differently about the city. I began to see it as a place where big moments in human lives take place. The climactic scenes in my two most recent novels, The Fault in Our Stars and Turtles All the Way Down, both take place at the corner of 86th and Ditch. And I think what people like about those books is Indianapolis. As with all the best sci-fi writers, Kurt Vonnegut was really good at seeing into the future. Way back in 1974, he wrote, "What should young people do with their lives today? Many things, obviously, but the most daring thing is to create stable communities in which the terrible disease of loneliness can be cured." That seems to me an even more important and more daring endeavor than it was 47 years ago. When people ask me why I live in Indianapolis when I could live anywhere, that's what I want to tell them. I am trying to create a stable community in which the terrible disease of loneliness can be cured. And you gotta do that somewhere. When I am sick with the disease of loneliness, good weather and shimmering skyscrapers do me no good whatsoever, as a writer or as a person. I must be home to do the work I need to do. And yes, home is that house where you no longer live. Home is before, and you live in after. But home is also what you are building and maintaining today. And I feel rather lucky in the end to be making my home just off of Ditch Road. I give Indianapolis 4 stars. Kentucky Bluegrass. Sometimes I like to imagine benevolent aliens visiting Earth. In my daydreams, these aliens are galactic anthropologists seeking to understand the cultures, rituals, preoccupations, and divinities of various sentient species. They would conduct careful field research observing us. They would ask open-ended, non-judgmental questions like, what or whom is in your view worthy of sacrifice? And what should be the collective goals of humanity? I hope these alien anthropologists would like us. We are, in spite of it all, a charismatic species. In time, the aliens would come to understand almost everything about us, our ceaseless yearning, our habit of wandering, how we love the feeling of the sun's light on our skin. At last, they would have only one question remaining. We have noticed that there is a green god you keep in front of and behind your houses, and we have seen how you are devoted to the care of this ornamental plant god. You call it Kentucky bluegrass, although it is neither blue nor from Kentucky. Here is what we are wondering. Why do you worship this plant species? Why do you value it over all the other plants? Poa pratensis, as it is known to the scientific community, is ubiquitous the world over. Much of the time, when you see a soft, green expanse of lawn, you're looking, at least in part, at Kentucky bluegrass. The plant is native to Europe, Northern Asia, and parts of North Africa, but according to the Invasive Species Compendium, it is now present on every continent, including Antarctica. The typical shoot of Poa pratensis has 3 to 4 leaves shaped like little canoes, and if left unmown, it can grow to 3 feet tall and sprout blue flower heads. But it is rarely left unmown, at least not in my neighborhood, where it is illegal to allow your grass to grow more than 6 inches long. If you've ever driven through my home state of Indiana, you've seen mile after mile of cornfields. Amber waves of grain are enshrined in the song America the Beautiful. But more land and more water are devoted to the cultivation of lawn grass in the United States than to corn and wheat combined. There are around 163,000 square kilometers of lawn in the U.S., greater than the size of Ohio or the entire nation of Italy. Almost 1/3 of all residential water use in the U.S., clean, drinkable water, is dedicated to lawns. To thrive, Kentucky bluegrass often requires fertilizers and pesticides and complex irrigation systems, all of which we offer up to the plant in abundance, even though it cannot be eaten by humans or used for anything except walking and playing on. The U.S.'s most abundant and labor-intensive crop is pure, unadulterated ornamentation, One could make a case for Poa pretensis in the Anthropocene if lawn grass was uniquely good at capturing carbon dioxide, but lawn maintenance creates more carbon emissions than lawns themselves can capture. It would be vastly better from an emissions perspective to have unkept grasses or clover or ivy or really anything that doesn't need constant resource-intensive care. The word lawn didn't even exist until the 1500s. Back then, lawns referred to expanses of grass shared by communities to feed grazing livestock, as opposed to fields, which denoted land used to grow plants for human consumption. But by the 18th century in England, ornamental lawns similar to the ones we know now had emerged. Back then, lawns were maintained by handheld scythes and shears, so keeping a lawn without the help of grazing animals was a sign that you were rich enough to hire lots of gardeners, and also to own land that did nothing but look good. The ornamental lawn fad spread throughout Europe and also to the United States, where people enslaved by Thomas Jefferson maintained a closely mown lawn at Jefferson's estate, Monticello. Over time, the quality of lawns in a neighborhood began to be seen as a proxy for the quality of the neighborhood itself. In The Great Gatsby, Jay Gatsby pays for his gardeners to mow his neighbor's lawn before Daisy Buchanan visits. Or, to cite an example closer to home, when I first moved to Indianapolis in 2007, I suddenly found myself the owner of a lawn, which I struggled mightily to maintain. Although we lived on only a third of an acre, it took my little electric lawnmower and me 2 hours to cut all the grass. One Sunday afternoon, my next-door neighbor interrupted me mid-mow and offered me a beer. As we stood in my half-mown yard, he said, "You know, when the Kaufmans lived here, this was the nicest lawn in the neighborhood." "Well," I answered after a while, "the Kaufmans don't live here anymore." It is truly staggering how much of our shared resources we devote to Kentucky bluegrass and its cousins. To minimize weeds and make our lawns as thickly monocultured as possible, Americans use 10 times more fertilizer and pesticide per acre of turf grass than is used in corn or wheat fields. To keep all the lawns in the U.S. green year-round requires, according to a NASA study, around 200 gallons of water per person per day, and almost all of the water shooting from sprinklers is treated drinking water. Grass clippings and other yard waste constitute 12% of all the material that ends up in U.S. landfills. And then there is the direct financial outlay. We spend tens of billions of dollars a year on lawn maintenance. We do get something in exchange, of course. Kentucky bluegrass provides a good surface for soccer and games of tag. Lawn grass cools the ground and offers some protection from wind and water erosion. But there are better, if less conventionally beautiful, alternatives. One could, for instance, devote a front yard to growing plants that humans can eat. I know all of this, and yet I still have a lawn. I still mow it or pay someone else to. I don't use pesticides and welcome clover and wild strawberries as part of the lawn, but still, there's a lot of Kentucky bluegrass in our yard, even though Poa pretensis has no business being in Indianapolis. It strikes me as interesting that in contrast to proper gardening, lawn maintenance doesn't involve much physical contact with nature. You're mostly touching the machines that mow or edge the grass, not the plant matter itself. And if you've got the kind of Gatsby lawn we're all told to reach for, you can't even see the dirt beneath the thick mat of grass. And so mowing Kentucky bluegrass is an encounter with nature, but the kind where you don't get your hands dirty. I give Poa pretensis 2 stars. The Indianapolis 500. Every year near the end of May, between 250,000 and 350,000 people gather in the tiny enclave of Speedway, Indiana, to watch the Indianapolis 500. It is the largest annual non-religious gathering of human beings on Earth. Speedway is surrounded by, but technically independent from, Indianapolis. Basically, Speedway is to Indianapolis as the Vatican is to Rome. The Vatican comparisons don't end there, actually. Both Speedway and the Vatican are cultural centers that draw visitors from around the world. Both contain a museum. And Speedway's racetrack, while commonly called the Brickyard, is also sometimes known as the Cathedral of Speed. Of course, the Vatican analogy falls apart if you dig deeply enough. In my admittedly few trips to the Vatican, I have never been offered an ice-cold Miller Lite by a stranger, whereas that happens often when I visit Speedway. At first blush, the Indianapolis 500 seems tailor-made for ridicule. I mean, it's just cars driving in circles. The drivers literally go nowhere. The race is crowded and usually hot. One year, my phone case partially melted in my pocket while I sat in the Turn 2 grandstand. It's also loud. Every May, I can hear the cars practicing when I am working in my garden, even though the Speedway is 5 miles from my house. As a spectator sport, the 500 leaves much to be desired. No matter where you sit or stand, you can't see the entire track, so important events take place that you cannot follow. Because some cars are laps ahead of others, it's almost impossible to know who's winning the race unless you bring oversized headphones to listen to the radio broadcast of the event you are watching. The largest crowd to watch a sporting event every year cannot see most of the sporting event. But it's been my experience that almost everything easy to mock turns out to be interesting if you pay closer attention. The Indy 500 features open wheel racing, which is to say that the wheels of the cars are not covered by fenders, and the driver's cockpit is open to the elements. Some truly amazing engineering is involved in getting these cars to travel more than 220 miles per hour around the 2.5-mile course. The cars have to be fast, but not so fast that the G-forces in the corners cause drivers to lose consciousness. The cars have to be responsive and predictable and reliable, because while driving at 220 miles per hour, these open-wheeled vehicles are often inches away from one another. For more than 100 years, the Indianapolis 500 has been examining a question that is of serious concern to people in the Anthropocene. What is the proper relationship between human and machine? Today, the track is entirely asphalt, except for a single yard of red bricks at the finish line. But when the first Indianapolis 500 took place on May 30, 1911, the track was paved entirely with bricks, 3.2 million of them. The winner of that first 500-mile race was Ray Haroon, who was driving a car that featured his own invention, the rearview mirror. In fact, many early automotive innovators were involved with the Indianapolis 500. Louis Chevrolet, who founded the car company, owned a racing team. His brother Gaston won the Indianapolis 500 in 1920, only to die later that year in a race at the Beverly Hills Speedway. Indeed, racing cars is an exceptionally dangerous sport. 42 drivers have died at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway in the track's history. Many more have been injured, some seriously. In 2015, IndyCar driver James Hinchcliffe nearly died after a crash at the Speedway severed a femoral artery. There's no escaping the uncomfortable fact that one of the thrills of racing is how close drivers get to the edge of disaster. As the legendary driver Mario Andretti put it, If everything seems under control, you're just not going fast enough. But I do think car racing accomplishes something. It takes both the person and the machine to the edge of possibility. And in the process, we get faster as a species. It took Ray Haroon 6 hours and 42 minutes to drive the first 500 miles at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. It took 2018 winner Will Power just under 3 hours. That's his real name, by the way, Will Power. Nice guy. Once I was standing by a valet stand next to Will Power, and when the valet showed up with my 2011 Chevrolet Volt, Will Power said to me, "You know, I am also a Chevrolet driver." It's a true story. But the Indy 500 isn't really about going fast. It's about going faster than everyone else, which reflects one of my top-level concerns about humanity. We cannot seem to resist the urge to win. Whether it's climbing El Capitan or going to space, we want to do it, but we also want to do it before anyone else or faster than anyone else. This drive has pushed us forward as a species, but I worry it has also pushed us in other directions. On the day of the Indy 500, though, I don't think about what the race means. I'm not considering the ever-diminishing distinction between humans and their machines, or the Anthropocene's accelerating rate of change. Instead, I am merely happy. My best friend Chris Waters calls it Christmas for grown-ups. My race day starts at 5:30 in the morning. I make a cup of coffee, check the weather, and fill my backpack cooler with ice, water, beer, and sandwiches. By 6, I'm checking my bike to make sure the tires are properly inflated and that my patch kit is ready. Then I bike down to Bob's Food Mart, where I meet up with friends and begin the beautiful early morning bicycle trip down Indianapolis's Central Canal towpath. Some years, it's raining and cold. Other years, the heat is overwhelming. But it is always beautiful, riding and joking with my friends and their friends, many of whom I see only once a year. We bike down to Butler University's track, where every year, two of our friends engage in a one-mile foot race at 7 in the morning. The IndyCars get faster decade over decade, but the foot race slows down. We place bets, and one or the other of them wins, and then we get back on our bikes for a couple miles before stopping again outside the Indianapolis Museum of Art, where we meet up with more people until we are a traveling band of 100 or so bicycles. Everyone waves as we bike by. "Have a good race," we say to one another, or else, "Stay safe." We're together, you see. We bike until the trail dead ends at 16th Street, and then begin the long trip west, merging with the cars that are already stuck in traffic, even though the race won't begin for 5 more hours. We bike single file for a nervous-making 10 blocks before turning into the town of Speedway. People are sitting out on their porches. Occasionally, a cheer will erupt from seemingly nowhere. Everyone is selling their front yards as parking spots, shouting out prices. The noise level is rising now. I don't like crowds, but I like this crowd because I'm in an us that doesn't require a them. We make it to the speedway, chain our bikes to a fence near turn 2, and then head our separate ways. Some of us like to watch the race from turn 2, others at the start-finish line. There are more traditions to come, the singing of "Back Home Again" in Indiana, some second-tier celebrity saying, "Drivers, start your engines," the parade laps, and the race itself. Tradition is a way of being with people, not just the people you're observing the traditions with now, but also all those who've ever observed them. I'm able to write all of this in the present tense because these traditions function as a kind of continuity. They happened, yes, but they are still happening and will go on happening. The rupture of that continuity was part of what made May of 2020 so difficult for me. As the pandemic took hold, I felt as if I was being unmoored from what I thought was reality. So much that had recently been extraordinary, wearing a mask, being conscious of every surface I touched or every human I walked past, was in the process of becoming mundane. And so much that had recently been mundane was becoming extraordinary. The Sunday before Memorial Day of 2020, I packed my backpack as usual, and Sarah and I got on our bikes as usual. Near Bob's Food Mart, we met up with our friends Anne-Marie and Stuart Hyatt. We wore masks as we biked down to the speedway, where the gates were locked shut. It was so quiet, so impossibly quiet, as we sat in a vast and empty parking lot. When the race finally did happen, in August, it was held without fans for the first time. I watched it on TV and found it interminably boring. But I'm thinking back to 2018. Dozens of us are locking our bikes to the chain link fence and scattering about to our various seats in the crowded grandstands. In 4 or 5 hours, we will meet back at the fence, unlock our bikes, and repeat the rituals on the way home. We will talk about how this happened or that happened, how we are happy for Will Power, who is such a good guy and finally got his Indy 500 victory. I'll tell my Will Power story, only to learn that many of my friends also have Will Power stories. Speedway is a small town, after all, even on this day, and we are in it together. I give the Indianapolis 500 4 stars. Mortification. The word mortification originally meant to cause death. Like, once upon a time, being mortified by shame meant literally dying from it. Mortification was then adopted into a religious context to refer to rituals meant to subdue the body and its desires, to cause the death of the flesh so that the spirit might strengthen. These days, mortification mostly means to experience extreme embarrassment. And I think it speaks to how utterly social and community-focused humans are that even in the age of self-isolation, we view embarrassment, especially public embarrassment, as a low-level form of death. Another sign of mortification's importance: I don't remember what I ate for dinner last Tuesday, and I regularly forget where I left my phone, but I can recall my every mortification as if it occurred moments ago. I know this because each evening, when I finish reading for the night, I'll turn off my bedside lamp, roll over onto my side, close my eyes, and my brain will say, "Oh, good evening. Should we play the blooper reel?" And I'll say, I'd really rather not. And my brain will say, "Excellent. Let's begin in a high school auditorium outside of San Francisco." The year is 2008, and I'm wearing, I can recall precisely what I was wearing, a pair of blue jeans, a green pinstriped button-down that I can only describe as vomit-shaded, and a brown suit jacket. And I'm standing before a crowd of several hundred high school students. In those days, the YouTube videos I made with my brother had a small but enthusiastic audience, and so when I would speak to an auditorium full of high school students, there would generally be one or two kids who were really excited, like wear homemade t-shirts dense with references to my novels excited, and then like 698 kids who just wanted to get out of English class for an afternoon. And so, usually, I would struggle to hold the attention of these audiences. But on this occasion, I was on fire. As I went through my 45-minute talk, there was laughter the whole way through, even when I wasn't trying that hard to be funny, and everyone was looking right at me, appearing genuinely enthralled. And then I reached the end of the talk, and there was a big round of applause, and when I asked if there were any questions, several dozen people raised their hands simultaneously, which was very unusual. So I pointed to one student, and they said, "Yeah, Mr. Green, are you aware that your fly is open?" I looked down, and my zipper wasn't just unzipped. My fly was open, as this student had aptly pointed out. And then I said, "No, I wasn't aware." And I turned around, zipped up my fly, and turned back around and said, "Are there any other questions?" And thereafter followed the longest and most absolute silence I have ever encountered. And so my brain will circumambulate that particular memory before moving through a catalog of the greatest hits. The time I told a famous YouTuber I liked his new show, and he said, "Do you mind if I ask what you like about it?" And I stumbled through a muttered incoherence because I hadn't actually seen his new show. The time I referred to a hectare, a unit of land area, as a hectaker 12 times in a single YouTube video. The time in high school when I wanted to sound smart, so I said that Goethe's Faust had heavily influenced Marlowe's Dr. Faustus, even though Dr. Faustus was written 200 years before Faust. And then there's the day after my first novel, Looking for Alaska, was published in 2005. I had a book signing at Anderson's Bookstore in the Chicago suburbs, and Sarah and I drove out to the store that evening to discover that two people, one of whom was my boss but kindly pretended to be a stranger, were in attendance. I decided to go ahead with my presentation anyway, and I read a passage from early in the book when the narrator has a disappointing going-away party. The passage in question ends with the following sentence: "The only thing worse than having a party no one attends is having a party attended only by two vastly, deeply uninteresting people." And then I looked up and realized I'd managed to offend the only two people who came to my book launch. Here is the extent to which mortifications penetrate my brain like nothing else. Looking for Alaska was published over 16 years ago. I can't quote a single line of it to you, except that line. There are more, of course. The time I was at a party and met a famous actor, and then later at the same party, someone introduced us again, and I said, "It's nice to meet you," and she said, "We were introduced 3 minutes ago." Or the time when I was meeting with advertising company CEOs, and one of them told me, "I'm really tired of being talked down to by idiots like you." The time I met Dwayne "The Rock" Johnson and couldn't think of what to say to him, and so muttered, "You're just awesome." The list goes on and on and on and on. In fact, I can report from experience that a full accounting of my mortifications requires an entire evening to get through, and then finally, my brain will free me from the litany around 6:15 in the morning, just in time for the alarm to go off. So what is it about embarrassment and shame that sears into us in ways that joy and even criticism don't? We're starting to learn more about this from neuroscience. We now know, for instance, that the neurotransmitter norepinephrine is released into the brain during highly embarrassing moments, as it is during tragic or traumatic situations. And it seems that chemical is important for creating and retrieving long-term, highly detailed memories, which is one of the reasons that traumatic memories can be so acutely detailed and sensory. Also, I guess there are reasons to hold on to embarrassing memories, like recalling the moment I mistook hectaker for hectare encourages me to fact-check my work more carefully and consistently. and I suppose remembering the dressing down I received from that advertising company's CEO taught me that I can probably live out the rest of my days quite happily without ever again being in a room full of advertising company CEOs. But there's something else going on as well, at least with my mortifications, which is that they often involve being in public, and either being in my role as a public person, or else being near people I admire or feel some kind of awe toward. Actors, business executives, The Rock. Perhaps that's because first impressions do matter, especially when they are likely to also be final impressions, as when I met Dwayne Johnson. And so, if you make a bad impression, it feels especially embarrassing. But I can't claim to fully understand mortification or why it plays such a huge role in my life. I do know, however, that I've been on both sides of that experience. While I am, quite obviously, not The Rock, I do still sometimes hear from people who met me at a book signing or out in public somewhere that they feel mortified by something they said or didn't say. And if anyone out there has such a feeling, I'd like to offer a blanket absolution. Whatever you said, don't feel embarrassed about it. It's okay. We're all just doing our best, trying to make our way through this veil of mortifications. And actually, maybe I tell these stories to you as a way of trying to transform the memories, trying to render them funny and ultimately toothless rather than the cause of actual sleepless nights. Because I do often find that when I tell people about my mortifications, they usually respond very generously. "That's not so bad," they'll say. "You shouldn't feel too bad about that one." And then I tell the story about two vastly, deeply uninteresting people, and whoever's listening to my story will pause for a bit before saying, "Okay, yeah, that one, not great." I give mortification 1.5 stars. Monopoly. When my family and I play Monopoly, a board game in which the goal is to bankrupt your fellow players, I sometimes think about Universal Paperclips, a 2017 video game created by Frank Lance. In Universal Paperclips, you play the role of an artificial intelligence that has been programmed to create as many paperclips as possible. Over time, you produce more and more paperclips until eventually you exhaust all of Earth's iron ore, whereupon you send probes to outer space to mine paperclip materials from other planets and then eventually other solar systems. After many hours of play, you finally win the game. You've turned all the universe's available resources into paperclips. You did it. Congratulations. Everyone is dead. In Monopoly, you land on various properties as you move around a square board. In the original game, the properties are from a fictionalized version of Atlantic City, New Jersey, but that changes depending on region and edition. For instance, in the Pokemon version of the game, properties include Tangela and Raichu. Regardless, if you land on an unclaimed property, you can purchase it, and if you establish a monopoly by purchasing related properties, you can build houses and hotels. When other players land on places you own, they must pay you rent, acquire enough properties, and the rent becomes unsustainable for your fellow players, and they go bankrupt. There are many problems with Monopoly, but maybe the reason the game has persisted for so long, it has been one of the world's best-selling board games for over 80 years, is that its problems are our problems. Like life, Monopoly unfolds very slowly at first and then becomes distressingly fast at the end. Like life, People find meaning in its outcomes, even though the game is rigged toward the rich and privileged, and insofar as it isn't rigged, it's random. And like life, your friends get mad if you take their money, and then, no matter how rich you are, there's an ever-expanding void inside of you that money can never fill, but gripped by the madness of unregulated enterprise, you nonetheless believe that if you just get a couple more hotels or take from your friends their few remaining dollars, you will, at last, feel complete. To me, the worst thing about Monopoly is its convoluted, self-contradictory analysis of capitalism. The game is essentially about how acquiring land is literally a roll of the dice, and how the exploitation of monopolies enriches the few and impoverishes the many. And yet, the point of the game is to get as rich as you can. Monopoly's mealy-mouthed take on economic inequality is also like life, at least life in Monopoly's home nation of the United States, where many of us think of billionaires the way I thought of the popular kids in middle school. I despised them, but I also desperately wanted to be them. In Monopoly's case, the thematic inconsistency of the game is largely a product of its complicated origin story, which turns out to say far more about capitalism than the game itself does. Here's the creation myth as it gets told by Monopoly's current owner, the toy company Hasbro. In 1929, in the wake of the great stock market crash, 40-year-old Charles Darrow lost his job in Philadelphia and was forced to scratch together a living as a door-to-door salesman. But then, in 1933, he invented the board game Monopoly, eventually patenting the game and licensing it to the company Parker Brothers. Darrow became the first board game millionaire, a proper rags-to-riches story of an American inventor succeeding via the sweat of his Randian brow. It's a great story. So great, in fact, that many copies of Monopoly have been printed with Darrow's biography alongside the rules. Today, there's even a plaque in Atlantic City celebrating Charles Darrow. The only problem with the story is that Charles Darrow did not invent Monopoly. Almost 30 years earlier, a woman named Elizabeth McGee created a board game called The Landlord's Game. As detailed in Mary Pylon's wonderful book, The Monopolists, McGee was a writer and actor who supported her artistic pursuits with a career as a stenographer and typist, work that she hated. "I wish to be constructive," she once said, "not a mere mechanical tool for transmitting a man's spoken thoughts to letter paper." In her lifetime, McGee was best known for a newspaper ad in which she offered herself up for sale to the highest bidder. She described herself as, quote, "not beautiful, but very attractive, and a woman of strong bohemian characteristics." The ad, which made national news, was meant to call attention to the discrimination against women in every aspect of American life, which forced them out of the workforce and into subservient roles in marriage. She told a reporter, "We are not machines. Girls have minds, desires, hopes, and ambitions." McGee also felt that no feminist movement could succeed without larger changes in the economic system. "In a short time," she said, "men and women will discover that they are poor because Carnegie and Rockefeller have more maybe than they know what to do with." To help show this to the world, in 1906, McGee created The Landlord's Game. McGee was a follower of Henry George, an economist who believed, as Antonia Nori Farzan put it in the Washington Post, that railroads, telegraphs, and utilities should be publicly owned rather than controlled by monopolies, and that land should be considered common property. McGee designed The Landlord's Game to illustrate George's ideas and believed that as children played it, they would, quote, see clearly the gross injustice of our present land system. The Land Wars game was similar to Monopoly in many ways. Like Monopoly, it had a square board with properties, and like Monopoly, if you made a bad roll, you could go to jail. But McGee released her game with two sets of rules. In one, the goal, like contemporary Monopoly, was to impoverish your opponents and acquire land monopolies. In the other set of rules, all were rewarded when wealth was created, as Pylon put it. One set of rules showcased how rent systems enriched landlords while keeping tenants poor, leading to capital over time concentrating in fewer and fewer hands. The other set sought to suggest a better way, in which wealth generated by the many was shared by the many. The monopolist rules for the Land Wars game proved more popular, and as college students learned the game and played handmade versions of it, they expanded and changed rules to make it even more similar to the Monopoly we know today. An Indianapolis version, called The Fascinating Game of Finance, was released in 1932, and it was in Indianapolis that a woman named Ruth Hoskins learned the game. She soon moved to Atlantic City and adapted the game to her new hometown. Hoskins taught the game to many people, including a couple who later moved to Philadelphia, where they taught the fascinating game of finance to a guy named Charles Todd, who in turn taught it to Charles Darrow. Darrow then asked for a copy of the rules, altered some of the design, patented the game, and became a millionaire. Here's how much Charles Darrow did not invent Monopoly. Marvin Gardens, that's M-A-R-V-E-N Gardens, is a neighborhood near Atlantic City. In Charles Todd's version of the game, which he learned by way of Ruth Hoskins, the neighborhood is misspelled as M-A-R-V-I-N Gardens. That misspelling is repeated in Darrow's version of the game, as is almost every other facet of Ruth Hoskins' version, because Charles Darrow did not invent Monopoly. So the story we hear of an individual rightly rewarded for his genius turns out to be a far more complicated story of a woman who created a game that thousands of collaborators then improved by playing it. A story of capitalism working turns out to be a story of capitalism failing. So many people got robbed by Darrow's monopolism, but Elizabeth McGee's loss is especially galling, because it wasn't only her game that got buried by Monopoly, but also the ideals she worked so hard to share. McGee's rebuke of unregulated extractive capitalism was transformed into a celebration of getting rich by making others poor. In the game of Monopoly, power and resources get unjustly distributed until one individual ends up with everything. And only in that sense is it Charles Darrow's game. Still, more than 100 years after McGee first debuted the Land Wars game, Hasbro continues to credit Charles Darrow as the inventor of Monopoly, and will say of Elizabeth McGee only, "There have been a number of popular property trading games throughout history. Elizabeth McGee, a writer, inventor, and feminist, was one of the pioneers of land-grabbing games." In short, Hasbro still refuses to acknowledge that the land they grabbed was never theirs for the taking. I give Monopoly 1.5 stars. Super Mario Kart. Super Mario Kart is a racing game, first released in 1992 for the Super Nintendo, in which characters from the Mario universe squat atop go-karts, rather like I do when trying to ride my daughter's tricycle. It was initially slated to be a game with Formula One-style cars, But technical constraints forced the designers to build tightly woven tracks that folded in on themselves, the kind that only go-karts can navigate. The game was co-created by Super Mario Bros. Lead designer and video game legend Shigeru Miyamoto, who would later say, "We set out to make a game where we could display the game screen for two players at the same time." This split-screen mode is part of what made the first Super Mario Kart game so thrilling. In the original Super Nintendo game, players can choose from among 8 characters in the Mario universe, including Princess Peach, Mario, Luigi, and Donkey Kong Jr. Each character has particular strengths and weaknesses. Bowser, for instance, is strong and travels at a high top speed, but accelerates very slowly. Toad, on the other hand, is quick and handles well, but has a lower top speed. Once you choose a character, I recommend Luigi, you're pitted against the 7 other drivers in a series of increasingly surreal tracks. You might navigate a regular pavement go-kart track, or a ship of ghosts, or a castle, or the famed Rainbow Road, which has a many-splendored driving surface and no guardrails to prevent you from falling into the abyss below. I was in 10th grade when Super Mario Kart was released, and as far as my friends and I were concerned, it was the greatest video game ever. We spent hundreds of hours playing it. The game was so interwoven into our high school experience that even now, the soundtrack takes me back to a linoleum-floored dorm room that smelled like sweat and Gatorade. I can feel myself sitting on a golden microfiber couch that had been handed down through generations of students trying to outturn my friends Chip and Sean on the final race of the Mushroom Cup. We almost never talked about the game while playing it. We were always talking over each other about our flailing attempts at romance, or the ways we were oppressed by this or that teacher, or the endless gossip that churns around insular communities like boarding schools. We didn't need to talk about Mario Kart, but we needed Mario Kart to have an excuse to be together, 3 or 4 of us squeezed on that couch, hip to hip. What I remember most was the incredible, and for me, novel, joy of being included. Like the rest of us, Mario Kart has changed a lot since I was in high school. In the recently released Mario Kart 8, you can fly and go underwater and drive upside down. You can now choose from among dozens of playable characters and vehicles. But at its core, the game hasn't changed much. Mostly, you win contemporary Mario Kart games in the same way you won them in 1992, by driving in the straightest possible line and cornering well. There is a measure of skill involved. You can carry speed better through corners by drifting, for instance, and there's some strategy to passing. But Mario Kart is almost ridiculously straightforward. Except, that is, for the question boxes, which make Mario Kart either a brilliant game or a problematic one, depending on what you think games should do. As you navigate a track in Mario Kart, you may pass over or through question boxes, at which point you receive one of several tools. You might get a mushroom, which you can use to get a one-time speed boost, or you might get a red turtle shell, a kind of heat-seeking missile that will go looking for the cart in front of you and hit it from behind, causing that cart to spin out. Or you might get the coveted lightning bolt, which makes all your opponents miniaturized and slow for a bit, while you remain as big and fast as ever. In the newer editions of Mario Kart, your question box might even provide you with the chance to transform for a few seconds into Bullet Bill, a speeding bullet that corners amazingly and destroys every cart in its path. Once I was playing Mario Kart 8 with my son, and because I am in my 26th year of regular Mario Kart play, I was leading the game comfortably. But then, on the last lap, he got Bullet Bill from a question box and proceeded to blow right past me, winning the race and destroying my kart in the process. I ended up finishing fourth. This sort of thing often happens in Mario Kart because the question boxes know if you're in first place. If you are, you'll usually get a banana peel or a coin, which are minimally useful. You'll never get one of those sweet bullets. But if you're in last place, because, say, you're an 8-year-old playing a grizzled Mario Kart veteran, you're much more likely to get lightning or Bullet Bill or an infinite supply of speed boost mushrooms. In a Mario Kart game, the best player still usually wins, but luck plays a significant role. Mario Kart is more poker than chess. Depending on your worldview, the question boxes either make the game fair, because anyone can win, or they make the game unfair, because the person with the most skill doesn't always win. In that respect, at least in my experience, real life is the precise opposite of Mario Kart. In real life, when you are ahead, you are given lots of power-ups to get further ahead. After one of my books became commercially successful, for instance, my bank called to inform me that I would no longer be charged ATM fees, even if I used an ATM from a different bank. Why? Because people with money in the bank get all kinds of perks just for having money in the bank. Then there are the much bigger power-ups, like the graduating from college with no debt power-up, or the being white power-up, or the being male power-up. This doesn't mean that people with good power-ups will succeed, of course, or that those without them won't, but I don't buy the argument that these structural power-ups are irrelevant. The fact that our political, social, and economic systems are biased in favor of the already rich and the already powerful is the single greatest failure of the American democratic ideal. I have benefited from this directly and profoundly for my entire life. Almost every time I've driven through a question box in my life, I have been given, at the very least, a red turtle shell. It happens so routinely that it's easy for those of us who benefit from these power-ups to see them as fair. But if I don't grapple with the reality that I owe much of my success to injustice, I'll only further the hoarding of wealth and opportunity. Some might argue that games should reward talent and skill and hard work precisely because real life doesn't. But to me, the real fairness is when everyone has a shot to win, even if their hands are small, even if they haven't been playing the game since 1992. In an age of extremes in gaming and elsewhere, Mario Kart is refreshingly nuanced. I give it 4 stars. Bonneville Salt Flats. In the winter of 2018, Sarah and I traveled to Wendover, a small town that straddles the border between Utah and Nevada. While there, almost as an afterthought, we visited the Bonneville Salt Flats, an otherworldly valley of salt-encrusted land on the western shore of the Great Salt Lake. Sarah is, by a wide margin, my favorite person. After the death of the poet Jane Kenyon, her husband Donald Hall wrote, "We did not spend our days gazing into each other's eyes. We did that gazing when we made love or when one of us was in trouble. But most of the time, our gazes met and entwined as they looked at a third thing. Third things are essential to marriages, objects or practices or habits or arts or institutions or games or human beings that provide a site of joint rapture or contentment. Each member of a couple is separate. The two come together in double attention. Hall goes on to note that third things might be John Keats or the Boston Symphony Orchestra or Dutch interiors or children. Our kids are critical sites of joint rapture for Sarah and me, but we have other third things too: the Sunday New York Times crossword puzzle, the books we read together, the TV show The Americans, and so on. But our first third thing was art. Sarah and I attended the same high school in Alabama, so we've known each other since we were kids. But we never really had a conversation until 2003, when we were both living in Chicago. Sarah was working in an art gallery then, and after we crossed paths a couple times and exchanged some emails, she invited me to the opening of an exhibition at the gallery featuring sculptures by the artist Ruby Chishti. I'd never been to an art gallery before, and at the time, I could not have named a single living artist, but I was fascinated by these sculptures. When Sarah took some time away from work that evening to talk to me about Chishti's work, I felt, for the first time, one of my favorite feelings in the world, the feeling of Sarah's gaze and mine meeting and entwining as we looked at a third thing. A few months later, after we'd exchanged dozens of emails, we decided to start a two-person book club. Sarah chose The Human Stain by Philip Roth as our first book. When we met to discuss it, we found that we had both underlined the same passage. The pleasure isn't owning the person. The pleasure is this, having another contender in the room with you. 15 years later, we were in Wendover to film for The Art Assignment, a series Sarah produced with PBS Digital